Chet Atkins is being interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place at his office at 100 Main Street on November 8, 1993. Chet Atkins is 45 years old. I find it of great interest that you told me that the first time you voted for yourself. I'd like you to take me back to that time and also some perspective of the changes within Concord that you experienced as you got yourself ready to be a candidate.
Well, I was at college at Antioch College in Ohio and had been very involved in anti-war activities and in community organizing, and had run a congressional campaign, a losing congressional campaign, for a Democratic candidate in a very Republican district in southern Ohio. And I had wanted very much to run for office. I had started working in presidential campaigns and had sort of worked my way down the political ladder on things. And I became aware that John McGlennon was planning on running for the Congress. So he would be leaving that state representative seat, which was Concord and Acton. And I decided to run to be a candidate. And what had happened that year was really...
And tell us what year.
1970 was a watershed year. And really, the watershed year had come in 1968, the elections in 68, and it was essentially political changes and political power, the shift of political power, catching up to demographic changes. That historically, Concord had been a Republican community, had never elected a Democrat in the state legislature from Concord. In that state representative seat, it had always been a Republican seat since there had been a Republican Party around the time of the Civil War. And what had happened was, in a sort of peculiarity to Massachusetts, the Republican Party had been the party of and particularly locally in Massachusetts, that was far more liberal on issues of personal freedoms, issues of birth control, which had been a critical and a very divisive issue in the 50s in the state, had been the liberal party on issues of race and of equality, and of civil rights. And so there was a lot of the old abolitionist activity, if you will, related to the Republican Party going way, way back. And that combined with a more conservative view in economics, and also combined with the cultural thing. I mean, politics have been very, very ethnic in Massachusetts in the early part of the 20th century, and you know, the Yankee Party was the Republican Party. There were very, very few sort of old New Englanders, if you will, Yankee types who had who were Democrats. The Democratic Party was the party of all the folks who would come in the starting in the 1840s, really the early waves of immigration, and there were just huge issues around that. All of that changed very clearly after the Second World War. You had a lot of professors, a lot of people from around the country, a mobility that you hadn't seen before, who were coming in and teaching at MIT and Harvard, Tufts, Boston University, people in the knowledge-based industries, and many of those people were Democrats. Democrats coming out of the whole New Deal experience, if you will, and then the Second World War. And it had taken a while for things to settle in the town, and the Democratic Party was all a party, always the party, and sort of viewed as the party of the, you know, the cities, the urban areas. The Republicans were the party of the suburbs, and Concord really was a rural area after the war, and the rural areas or semi-suburbs. And in the election of 1968, and really I think related to the Vietnam War, there was a massive shift, and there had been a split in the Democratic Party in Concord. The Democratic Party essentially was a stronghold in West Concord, a stronghold among people who worked at MCI Concord, people who were federal workers who worked in the post office and so forth. It was a small group, and there was strong ethnic differentiation at that time. That the party was heavily, heavily Irish. And of course, there was a split. A lot of the Italians had, because they were frozen out of the Democratic Party, had joined and become part of the Republican Party, and that really resulted in the successful candidacy of John Volpe as governor on the Republican ticket. In the 1968 election, the anti-war movement was very, very strong in Concord, and there was a melding. It was an uneasy melding, but a melding of the sort of the traditional Democratic, very minority core, and the sort of more intellectual, cerebral, liberal Democratic core that were many of the people who had moved out to town after World War II and in the 50s. So that that was finally, 68 was the turning point on that. I think in the election of 70, with John McLennan leaving, was sort of a perfect opportunity for the Democrats. I discovered shortly after I started exploring my candidacy that there was a very distinguished person who was also seeking the Democratic nomination, a fellow by the name of Jerry Bush, who's now a professor at Brandeis at the Heller School, who had been an assistant secretary of labor in the Kennedy administration under Willard Wirtz, who was a senior consultant at Arthur D. Little, a PhD, someone who had the, if you could say, the dream resume for Concord to run. He was married, a couple of kids, very attractive kids, a very personable person, etc., etc. And I think he had really been recruited by the Democratic Town Committee, and I think 33 of the 35 Town Committee members all supported his candidacy, and people just assumed that he would win, that he would get the Democratic nomination hands down. I came in, I was 10 years or so younger than Jerry Bush, had virtually no experience to speak of, hadn't even graduated from college, and started running, and I ran my race on a door-to-door basis. I had come, knocked on every door in town twice, and actually lived at that time and was on the ballot from Acton, even though I'd grown up in Concord. And I essentially was able, I lost the election by a couple of hundred votes, the primary election in Concord, but won by a pretty good margin in Acton. And I essentially just was able to outwork Jerry Bush and to take him by surprise, if you will. I've got to know Jerry very well since then. He's a good friend, and we often joke about who really won that election. He went on to be a vice president at Gulf Oil and then to have a very distinguished academic career.
Certainly the anti-war sentiment carried you through. You were also a reform type of candidate?
Yes, I ran on, and it was sort of a reversal, on a platform of dealing with the sort of patronage politics that dominated the state house and that dominated the state Democratic Party, and in a strong program of reforming the civil service system, which was a terrible problem at that time, and reforming state purchasing practices. And there was a very, very strong base for all of that with the local League of Women Voters. It was really a real power to be reckoned with, probably stronger in Concord in sort of political terms than either of the political parties. Mm. The League at that time, you just had a very, very large number of women who were highly educated, who were at home raising children. It was really the very beginning of the sort of large numbers of women going into the workforce. And so there was this extraordinary reservoir of talent and energy, a lot of it devoted to political activities through groups like the League of Women Voters.
Your Republican opponent was?
George Rowan, who ran the old, and still does, ran the old South Bridge Boathouse. And George was a kind of a classic Republican small businessman. I ran on that basis. By the time the general election came around, George hadn't had the kind of exposure that I'd had, the kind of energy and momentum that I had from the primary and from the primary win over Jerry Bush. And George really was, you know, was wiped out by a kind of aggressive campaign and by the fact that the demographics in town had changed.
I was curious about your own family. Did you grow up in a Democratic?
I did. My father was a diehard Stevenson Democrat, as was my mother. And we were family beyond that had been quite Republican, with the exception of my great-grandfather, who was one of the few sort of Boston Yankees who sided with James Michael Curley, and actually was a candidate for the U.S. Senate right after World War I against Henry Cabot Lodge.
So your family has roots in this area?
They do. I was born in Switzerland and grew up my early years in elementary school outside of Montreal, but my great-great-grandfather had a farm actually on Monument Street, where Hutchins Farm is now, just before the Civil War. So the family had some roots in Concord, although nobody had lived in the family in Concord since my, you know, between my great-great-grandfather and my parents.
And where did you grow up in Concord?
On Monument Street, right just across from the Old North Bridge, and that Great Meadows Road area.
Did it seem very symbolic to you growing up, or?
No, I think one of the things that happens when you're you're that close to history is you tend to be unmindful of it. It becomes very mundane. We had a small farm, sort of a hobby farm there. We had sheep and hogs and cattle, and occasionally we had a fence that really was not totally cattle resistant. The cattle would get out. We'd go across the street over to the Old North Bridge, and my job was to go down and get them and run them back up to our property. The Park Service, which had just taken over to the Old North Bridge, was not particularly happy stray cattle down there, which tended to scare some of the more urban visitors.
I believe in a preliminary conversation you had mentioned that Paul Cunahan was very active in reorganizing the Democratic Party in Concord.
Yes, Paul and Jen Cunahan were really the organizers and the folks who made that marriage between the sort of older, more traditional Democrats and the newer, more liberal Democrats. And that was, Paul was very active in 1968 and put together a new town committee slate for that.
And by this time also you seem to have many more developments, residential developments in Concord.
Well, people don't like to refer to any housing in town as development, I don't think, but there were an awful lot of areas of town that had been developed after the war, and there was a lot of growth, and a lot of it came from people who had come in to work for Raytheon and come in to work for the universities and for Lincoln Laboratories and places like that.
They tended to vote Democrat?
They were, you know, I think a lot of the folks were independents. Concord's always been a very independent mm-hmm. community. They were far more open to voting Democratic than mm-hmm. these people. And you also had a core of liberal Democrats. A lot of them associated with various universities.
Well, we'll call the developments neighborhoods. Now you're in the state legislature, and you come to Beacon Hill, and what do you find? You're idealistic?
Well, it was a kind of a rude awakening for me. I had was nurtured, if you will, and very ideological politics, and then nurtured in a very genteel political environment in Concord. And essentially what I found was a politics that was dominated by patronage, a politics that was very much personal for people, and personal struggles over jobs and powers and power, rather than a larger fight over ideas and principles. And my first experience was going up after I won the Democratic primary, was invited to the Democratic special sort of meeting for all the people who had won the primary in Middlesex County. And it was quite a shock going through that experience. And after this little lunch, there was a little curtain set up and a small card table, and we had a picture taken with the Speaker of the House, and then stepped behind the curtain and were asked to sign a pledge card. and then handed a check for our election campaigns, and I guess I was rather surprised, and having run my campaign as much against the Democratic leadership in the House as against the Republican. And of course, the big issue at this time was the House cut, something that had been pushed by the League of Women Voters. It was kind of confirmed every worst fear that I might have had about how things really happen in Beacon Hill.
Explain further.
Well, just the whole session, the very personal nature of the politics, and also the immense power of patronage.
Mm-hmm. Who was the Speaker of the House then?
Dave Bartley was at that time. And actually was, and I never really got along very well with Dave in my 2 years in the House, but got along with him much better later. He was somebody that, you know, stylistically worked in that world in the State House, but really made very significant contributions, and he was the one who pushed the Chapter 766, the special ed law, and really made a number of breakthroughs. I mean, it was an incredible dichotomy for him. On the one hand, and maybe the story of Massachusetts state politics, on the one hand, very significant breakthroughs and reforms in education, in health care, and caring for most vulnerable people, and on the other hand, just some sort of a method and a style of politics that was really, I think, resented by a lot of people in the state. And, you know, kind of a silliness. On the one hand, you know, he passed the 766 law that profoundly reformed education and provided and had an enormous effect on people's lives. I know both of our kids have gone through the 766 program in the Concord schools. They have the same dyslexia that I have. And it's really been an extraordinary success on the one hand. On the other hand, Dave's more known for beating the House cut, or not beating it, but actually having fighting against the House cut and then eventually losing on it.
Reducing the number of members of the House of Representatives?
Number of members, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How were you able to function then?
Well, in the 2 years I was in the House, I was very much a kind of an angry young man who really didn't have much contact with the leadership, fought against them on a number of things. And then 2 years later, in 1972, I was elected to the Senate. And when I got elected to the Senate, I was appointed chairman of the committee, of the Public Service Committee. And I was then in a position where, you know, it was very clear to me that in order to be effective, I had to understand the pressures and the priorities that other people were under, and that, you know, it wasn't that their politics was a lesser politics than mine, it was that their constituents expected different things from them than mine expected from me, and that their constituents are far more focused on, you know, politics as a means of upward social and economic mobility, a place where you could cut through bureaucracy and and have services provided that needed to be provided, and get a helping hand, and whether it was getting a summer job for your kid, or whether it was getting a child into the state school for the retarded, or getting a grandparent into a nursing home. Or
you were the enabler.
You were very much for people of those communities. They were the enabler. They were the human face to a fairly impersonal bureaucracy.
How did the Senate differ in any way from the House?
It was a much smaller, only 40 members in the Senate, so it had a much greater impact. Most of the Democrats in the Senate were committee chairmen. So it was a very different environment than the House, and essentially the Democratic leadership had the votes in the Senate to do pretty much what they wanted, so people didn't really call your vote very often, and there wasn't a sort of hard sense of party discipline, and if you don't vote the party line, you'll be punished, that I think exists in the House.
How long did you stay in the Senate?
I was there. I was elected in 1972 and stayed until 1984.
Enough to know some of the individuals that we certainly associate with Beacon Hill politics. I wonder if you can share your association and observation about a man like Billy Bulger, who's that has been his life.
Yeah, he's an extraordinarily bright person, and I think a very, very complex person who's greatly misunderstood. He's become demonized, I think, by the media, and in turn he has demonized the media. And he's somebody who has a sense of a strong sense of values, a very strong sense of ideology, and oftentimes people don't appreciate that he's not just some hack politician, but he has sort of clear sense of things that he believes in. Now, oftentimes those things are, and the sort of curiosity of it is that they tend to be, particularly on the social side, on questions like abortion rights, or in questions of many of, not so much civil rights, but affirmative action issues, tend to be very, very conservative. And his ideology is certainly very different from mine in ideological priorities, but he has a set of values that, in terms of loyalty, of family, of community, that are very similar to mine in many ways. He appointed me as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and I served in that position for 6 years, from 78 to 84, and it was a very, very productive relationship for me, that we had the areas where we differed, and I'll have to say that he was always respectful of those differences, and we go our separate ways on votes and issues like choice. On the other hand, we worked together on a large number of issues that I think made a profound difference in people's lives in the state. We made some significant reforms and I believe really changed the budgeting process in the state, and for all the image of Bulger as a tyrant and as a patronage person and so forth, a number of the reforms that we made were to limit the power of the legislature to get involved in personnel matters, in state personnel matters, and to rewrite the budget process so the legislature was not so focused on micromanagement, and rather was focused on larger and clearer issues of policy and setting policy and direction. And you know, there were a number of things we were able to do to both reform and bring efficiency to government agencies on the one hand, and on the other hand, to really focus efforts. We set it up, the early intervention program for children with various kinds of disabilities, so that you get involved right, really from the moment of birth with a child. Set up an extraordinary number of programs for prenatal care. Major commitment, major strides in health care, for in preventative health care for low-income people. Set up some model national programs in nutrition. Set up a number of programs in the environment, biggest since the New Deal, biggest program for open space acquisition and for preservation of our landscape in Massachusetts. Most aggressive program in the country for support for the arts and pushing the arts, not pushing them, but making the arts accessible in communities, and particularly in urban communities and to school kids. Major changes in improving and establishing centers of excellence in the public higher education system. Major change, and we adopted most of the League of Women Voters, their big program over the sort of late 60s, early 70s, was the fiscal program to deal with the inequities of the property tax and the inequities of educational opportunity, and we enacted virtually all of the League of Women Voters' fiscal agenda, and in fact hired the woman who ran the fiscal policy for me at the Ways and Means Committee to work on that, and she was in the fortunate position of having spent 8 years with the league setting up this program and working with it, and then spent the next 6 years enacting it into law. We're able to set up some major changes, major reforms in the state mental health system, and to really try to improve the process of deinstitutionalization and assure that people got services, set up some of the early national programs and pioneering programs for the homeless, set up the first programs and some of the first state support in the country for battered women. This was back in the 1970s, before it was the kind of issue that it is now. So there were, I could go on and on, a number of the things, and I feel very positive about the relationship that we had, and I think the things we were able to do to make a difference in the state and to make a difference in people's lives, particularly people who are the most vulnerable and at the greatest risk. The curious thing is that almost none of that, because it's done quietly, it's done collaboratively, it's not a source of great confrontation, almost none of that gets covered in the media. A lot of those reforms just happened very quietly and made profound differences in people's lives, but it was the sort of the pettiness, the fights, the personal, that's been the focus of a lot of the media coverage of things.
I'm interested in your observation and experience with the media.
Well, I think it's fair to say that I've always had a troubled relationship with the media, and I think most of that is because I started out as the, I guess almost as the ultimate outsider, and became the portrayal of the ultimate insider. And to me, the outsider and the insider images, and during that period of time, that was a means to an end. Means to an end for programs to carry out things that I think my constituents felt were important. And it was that whole question of style versus substance. And the media, I think, over the last decade or so has been focused on really deifying the outsider, the person who comes in who's going to tear down the system and is going to go against the powers that be, rather than the person who goes in and quietly tries to make change and to make a difference. And is focused maybe on doing that to the exclusion of some of the issues of political style or process. I'd say if there was a great mistake that I made in my career, it would be that I was always far more focused on the substance, getting something done, getting the right things done, than I was on appearances than I was on the process. I'd have to say that the Senate and the way the Senate worked, and actually it's a far more democratic institution now than it was then, but when I was chairman of Ways and Means, it was power was centered in a few people's hands. It was a very autocratic institution, and I was a part of running that and keeping that going. On the one hand, we have a record that I think is unparalleled in terms of reform and change and improvement in state services. On the one hand, on the other hand, it's not a healthy way long term, and I think you're seeing some of the results of it now, to run a legislative body.
Certainly, as head of the chairman of the House, the Ways and Means Committee, you certainly had the power there. How did it feel?
I was never, and I've never been one who either adored the spotlight or the personal attention. I've always been somewhat awkward with that, or who enjoyed the exercise of power for its own sake.
I didn't mean that, but, you know, the ability to drive things.
It was a great feeling to to have things happen.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great feeling to set up a program for housing and for community residences for the mentally retarded, and to set up a program of supported work for these people, and then to go out to the graduation of the first group of people who were in a community residence, going off to work every day, earning an income, had the pride and the sense of accomplishment that comes with that, and who had 2 short years earlier been in a state school and living in just horrendous conditions. And it was a wonderful feeling to see and to be a part of that, and to know that you'd help make that possible for these people.
What made you want to leave the state house, go on to Congress?
Well, in 1984, Paul Tsongas announced that he had cancer and was retiring from government. Jim Shannon, who was the congressman, announced that he was going to run for the U.S. Senate for Tsongas' seat, and that left the congressional seat open. Now, this Concord area was the very edge of the congressional district and not the center of a district that had been based in the Merrimack Valley and Lowell and Lawrence. But I had done, you know, in 6 years, I had done what extraordinary amount in the state senate, and, you know, it wasn't as much of a challenge, intellectual challenge for me. And I had originally, when I started out in politics, had planned that I would, you know, serve in the state legislature, then move up into a leadership position, perhaps as Senate president, and then go from there to run statewide, probably for governor. And I talked when the seat became open, talked with the Senate president about his plans and how long he had expected to.
And who was the Senate president?
That was Bulger at that time. Mm-hmm. And he told me that he expected to be there quite a while. And really, with very strong encouragement from my wife, I decided to make the race for the Congress. Now, I had been so focused for that 14 years in sort of state politics and state government and state issues. There was quite a change for me, even though I had started out focused on foreign policy issues and national issues. I went off to something very different, and it was an exciting time to go into Congress when I was elected, and it was a tremendous change for me in terms of the kinds of issues that I was focused on.
And your opponent?
Opponent in that race was, in the Democratic primary, state senator from Lowell. His name was Phil Shea. And then in the general election, a lawyer from Methuen, his name was Greg Hyatt.
You came to Washington. Was it a close election?
It was relatively close. The primary was quite close, and the primary was a sort of great geographical battle. Shea won with huge margins in Lowell and the Lowell suburbs. I won with huge margins down here in Concord and Wayland and Weston and Lincoln. And then we broke pretty close to even in Lawrence. And I was able to take decent margins in the sort of western towns, Harvard and Groton and Ayer, and those communities. I was able to beat him by, I forgot how many points, but it was close.
What were the big differences now that you were at the national level?
Well, it was a very, very different district, a much more urban district, a district that was far less liberal than I was. And it was a time when Reagan was, this was the middle 80s. Everybody was getting rich and didn't want to focus or deal with the kinds of issues that I was involved with, at least on a national level. Issues of reforming nutrition programs and issues of trying to deal with those folks who were left out of economic growth, environmental issues, environmental programs, and also some of the foreign policy issues, particularly in Southeast Asia. It turns out that in the city of Lowell, we had the largest, one of the two largest Cambodian communities. There had been a huge influx starting at in the beginning, in the early 1980s, of Cambodian and Laotian refugees, mostly people who had fled from Pol Pot and left Cambodia after the fall of Pol Pot. And I got very, very involved in U.S. policy in Cambodia and U.S. refugee policy. Not one of the great popular issues of our day, but something where I felt that I was able to make a significant difference.
Did running for re-election almost as soon as you get your feet wet, was that a problem for you?
No, because the economy was growing so fast in Massachusetts in the middle 80s that my first and second re-election so that was the U.S. policy in Southeast Asia was a big focus of my interest. The other was environmental policy. And that was a time when the Reagan administration was really just destroying our public lands. And while there are very few public lands in Massachusetts, they're part of our national heritage for all of us and vitally important for the ecological health of this country. And I was involved in fighting and in changing some of the policies of the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. And we had some significant successes. It's always hard and it's frustrating at a time like that when the country and the president are going in one direction and you're fighting against that direction, and sort of three-quarters of what you're doing is just making, causing bad things not to happen. And it's hard to take a lot of satisfaction out of that.
What were you preventing the Reagan administration from doing?
Oh, they had policy, just clear-cut vast amounts of old-growth timber in the Pacific Northwest. I was one of the authors of the plan that stopped a considerable portion of that and gave the environmental community the increased capacity to go into court to stop it. They had really destroyed a lot of the grasslands in the far west by a crazy grazing program, and restarted the efforts and made some progress in reform. And of course, that's an issue that's still today, as we speak, very, very hot, very, very significant issue. And then another issue that I spent a lot of my time on focusing on was the issue of the control that the tobacco industry had over the Congress and over U.S. government policy. And I particularly focused on tobacco and the U.S. tobacco, really the perversion of our foreign policy for U.S. tobacco exports. Really extraordinary what had happened over that decade of the early 80s, that the U.S., as smoking behaviors changed dramatically in the U.S., and there were fewer new smokers, and the older smokers were dying off. I mean, this is an industry that kills 400,000 of the best customers every year. That's the number of people who die from deaths that are related to smoking every year. So they had to find new customers. And they went abroad, and they used U.S. foreign policy and U.S. economic mind abroad to really coerce people into opening up markets and to force other companies to change their domestic laws, to allow advertising of cigarettes on TVs. I mean, just extraordinary. U.S. was threatening people with trade sanctions if they wouldn't allow advertising for cigarettes that's illegal in this country. Part of our national policy is just an absolute disgrace. And we were able to block them. We weren't totally successful, but the foreign policy has changed, and the control of tobacco in directing U.S. trade policy is far less, still far too great, but far less today than it was when we started that effort.
During this time, there supposedly was a Massachusetts miracle back home.
Mm-hmm.
That brings us back to a bit of your relationship with the governors of Massachusetts.
Sure. Going back to the sort of first step, Frank Sargent was governor when I was elected in 1970. Sargent, I think, was a wonderful governor. Did some extraordinary things in the state. I worked closely with him and with the governor's office, particularly when I was a state representative and in my early years in the state senate, and particularly in human service and environmental programs. Then Dukakis was elected, and I was very active in the first election of Mike Dukakis, and then very disappointed in his inability to get control of the state budget process and of state spending. And Dukakis lost in 78, and Ed King was elected, and I was at that point chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. I came in as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee as Ed King was elected governor. It was a very, very conservative Democrat, and fortunately for me, King didn't care too much about the details and really wasn't aware of a lot of the details of state policy making. So we were able to really enact, under this very conservative governor, a lot of changes in state policy that were totally antithetical to his ideology. And with his really in many instances being unaware of them. After that, I was involved in the re-election of Mike Dukakis, and his comeback was very active at that time, and was really, you know, worried about the Democratic Party under Ed King. Dukakis was re-elected, and we were allies on a lot of issues, but it was always a kind of an uneasy relationship, if you will. I think a lot of the things that later came to be Dukakis's undoing, I had fought with them as chairman of Ways and Means. And I think they thought that I should just kind of toe the line and do whatever the governor wanted as a Democratic chairman of Ways and Means. I had a strong sense that they were getting us into spending commitments that were not cost effective. I'd always taken a great deal of pride, and it sort of seemed my trademark as both expansion of programs that were high priority and efficient and effective programs on the one hand, and on the other hand, cutting back waste and abuse and assuring that there was real fiscal credibility. And unfortunately, that was ultimately Dukakis's undoing, and things. But I think he made some very significant and positive contributions to the state. A lot of them that I've forgotten.
But he was very much of a, almost a loner in his working style.
In his first administration, not in his second administration. Mm-hmm. Second administration, he was very, very collaborative, almost to a fault.
I see. Some people had felt that the governor's position was something that they thought you might be interested in.
Well, I was at one point, and that was my initial sort of interest in when I ran, the sort of goal that I was looking at. But I ultimately, as a result of really two things. One was my choice of taking an inside role, being more effective in the legislature, really precluded that. And the second was my my decision to focus heavily on national issues in the Congress and focus heavily on U.S. foreign policy and refugee policy. I mean, that was extraordinarily unpopular. Still is, but something that I thought was important.
When you're in Congress, you're once again faced in the House being one of a big multitude rather than the small nucleus from the Senate. How did that...
Well, it was difficult. It was a difficult transition from going to be right at the locus of power in the state legislature to being almost irrelevant in a 435-member House. And what I did was I chose to pick and choose certain areas where I built some expertise where I felt I could really make a difference. And that's part of the balance, that what you wind up doing is you get active on the things that are important for your district and to your constituents. And you spend a portion of your time working on those things, both those broad national things, and to make sure that you're involved there, even though you may not be the one shaping the national policy. And then you get involved in the whole struggle over the distribution of goods and services, you know, making sure that there's funding for the Third Harbor Tunnel, making sure that there's funding for the cleanup of Boston Harbor, those kinds of things. Which is always difficult, that fine line between sort of the role in Congress in the distribution of those federal resources, if you will, taxpayer resources, and just being a pork barreler. Mm-hmm. And then there was the whole issue of focusing on, you know, the issues that were broad national and international issues that may not be at the top of the priority list for your constituents, but where, as a freshman member and then as a fairly new member, you really had a capacity to make a change and to make significant changes. I don't think that U.S. export of cigarettes was on the top 10 of very many of my constituents. On the other hand, I think there was broad support for that. And that was an area where I could focus and could really have a substantial role in setting policy.
You were there 8 years?
Yes.
What were the highlights in your looking back with those 8 years?
I think highlights were my service in the budget committee and our ability to change with that committee, to change many of the priorities of the Reagan administration. Back and control a little bit the just sort of gross bulimic defense style that Reagan had established, and to really focus and have some increases in money for education, for college scholarships, for nutrition programs, and one program that I helped push and spend a lot of my time on, a program for, it's called Spousal Impoverishment. Actually started from both work at the Villers Foundation at that time, now Families USA, the foundation formed by Phil and Kate Villers, and also somebody in Concord that I knew, where if older couple, one of them had Alzheimer's, that in order to get treatment for that person, the other one would have to spend down their income into poverty. So you had this double situation. You had the tragedy of Alzheimer's, and then the spouse that didn't have it being forced into poverty, oftentimes forced to lose their home and other things. It was just craziness. So that was one set of accomplishments that I felt very proud of. I felt very proud of our success in changing and affecting some of the U.S. policy in Cambodia and in Southeast Asia to a policy that was more humane. When I started out in Congress, the U.S. government was under the table providing enormous support for Pol Pot. Here's a man who was responsible for the deaths of over 1 million of his countrymen, one of the most brutal genocidal fanatics in history. And the formal U.S. policy was to supply indirect support for Pol Pot so that he could topple a nominally communist government. Absolute insanity for that. And I was able to make a difference in that policy and some changes and to bring the policy to light. I was able to do some significant things in environmental policy, particularly in respect to public lands that I was very proud of those accomplishments. The work fighting the tobacco lobby. Also, some of the work here more locally. We had a terrible, terrible fight in Minuteman Park, and just an insane policy of expansion. The town really had no say in. It was a very difficult and brutal process, but I think we finally got a master plan for the park that will both highlight this park and that experience of the start of the American Revolution, but also we'll do it in a way that will maintain and help us maintain the character of Concord and provide minimal disruption to the town and the people who live here. Work that I did on the expansion of the Great Meadows National Wildlife Refuge and Walden Woods and Concord, Sudbury, and Assabet River Basin. And those are the work with the establishment and the growth of the Lowell National Historic Park, which had significant success in explaining the history of the American Revolution. It's fun to watch all of my kids and a lot of the local kids in Concord go through a whole study section on that and then go up and use that national park to understand that part of our history. Those are some of the successes, some of the issues that I was most proud of and interested in.
Did you find being in Washington a stimulating environment?
I did for the first 6 years. The last 2 years were really a miserable time. There was tremendous public and understandable public anger at the failure of the government and the society to really to meet people's needs, to deal with economic crisis that this country was facing. It's a huge anger at Congress, and then a kind of a press feeding frenzy on a number of sort of peripheral and, in the larger scheme of things, minor issues, but which came because of the way the House leadership had handled them, came to be sort of symbols of the disconnectedness of Congress with people's lives and the reality of people's lives.
And who was the House leadership?
Tom Foley was the speaker. Of course, I had been involved as a member of the Ethics Committee and a very, very difficult question and issue of the problems that Jim Wright, the previous speaker, had. And I ultimately wound up siding with the Republicans and creating a majority in the Ethics Committee and leveling the most serious charges against Speaker Wright. Something that I felt was necessary to do to maintain the integrity of the Congress.
This is helpful when people listen years later, so we place who, sure, you know, was in the leadership at the time. What was the greatest frustration of trying to work in Congress?
The greatest frustration is that Congress moves so slowly, and so hard to get. It's been 4 and 5 years working on an issue before you finally get some progress. And a frustration that there are so many demands now on a member of Congress that you just, you spend your time running around here and there, raising money for your reelection, doing media interviews, you know, meeting with local groups, et cetera, et cetera, but you don't have the kind of time to really understand issues the way you should and to really focus in and develop the kind of expertise that's necessary really to make policy.
There is a movement to limit the number of terms of office. In view of the fact that it takes so long, Congress moves so slowly, how is that a plus?
Well, I don't know. I guess I come from a position of having been very opposed to term limits, to one now that I'm ambivalent about them. I think term limits are probably a fact of life. I think the public is to be denied of that. And maybe they'll work.
Tell me about...
And maybe they'll work because people who have a limited period of time to get something done, power would be more open, would flow more freely, so that it won't, you won't have to serve those sort of long periods of apprenticeship. Maybe you'll attract people who bring to the office more life's experiences and more expertise when they step in on day one. And you'll be in a position where people, knowing that they only have a short period of time to make a difference, make a mark, will come in with a very clear agenda and a willingness to take risks that oftentimes people don't have now.
When you're campaigning, since taking you away from the business of Congress, you resent it?
No, to some extent it's the thing that roots you and grounds you in reality. Reality, to some extent, the disconnect of things that people are focused on in their lives and sort of the matters that Congress is working with, and how do you build the connection between those two? Because ultimately, Congress only succeeds, and members of Congress only succeed if the public has a sense that what Congress is doing is improving their lives.
Your district was changed.
Uh-huh.
Would you like to address how it was and how you feel that impacted the result of the last election?
Well, in the last election, in 1992, I lost a lot of my strongest communities, Weston, Lincoln, Framingham, and it was added a lot of new territory that was far more conservative. And
which was?
Bill Ricka and Tewksbury, those communities up there. And the net effect of all of that. But it wasn't just the redistricting, and I was somewhat of a target of the redistricting. And it's, I guess, sort of the ironies and the curiosities of my career that I've been both an insider, but never a real insider. And clearly the district was designed to try and make my reelection as difficult as possible, but there was also a number of other things that went on, and just general anger with Congress and geographical divisions with this district, and the enormous negatives that I built up by my sort of advocacy for the refugee policy and the Cambodian community in the rural area. And ultimately, I lost in the re-election, which in the larger scheme of things is probably was a very healthy thing, both for me and my family personally. I'm in a position now where I really have the freedom, and I'm able to in my business, to focus on some of the issues that I think are critical, and to not have to deal with all the headaches and the aggravations of running for office.
This was in the primary.
Yes.
Against me, Marty
Meehan.
Yeah.
The redistricting is done by the state legislature and by the governor. It was really Governor Weld who was particularly just looking to create some mischief, defeat as many Democrats. The redistricting proposal that they came up with, not so much in my district, but statewide, in order to get what they wanted to do in my district, was pretty ridiculous. They divided communities, and they've got one district that they call it the Ivy League district that stretches from Princeton in the Montechusett area all the way down to Dartmouth, which is next to New Bedford. It was a very political thing, a very partisan thing on the part of Governor Weld, and ultimately when it came right down to it, I didn't really have any strong defenders or advocates in the state legislature. And that was fine. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. I think the redistricting was unfortunate for the people of Massachusetts. It sort of indicated, not so much in my district, but other districts, the power of just kind of raw politics, with a total disregard for communities or for individuals, with just a strictly partisan purpose. And I think Weld is extraordinarily cynical that way in what he does. So that was, that was that.
So you're in consulting now?
Yes.
One last question. Did you ever go back to Antioch?
I've been back a few times, and I hope to go back.
I mean, but you completed your run for...
I got college credits, actually. Antioch's a very experimental school. I got college credits for running for office and graduated from Antioch with those credits.
Well, thank you.
Okay.